We are on the air. Welcome to the Evolution Eats podcast. My name is Noah.
And I'm Emily. And today we have one of my colleagues who went to the Friedman School of Nutrition at Tufts with me. She has a master's in nutritional epidemiology, also a master's in neuroscience. She recently has become a registered dietitian, and her name is Carrie Chris. Welcome to our podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on, guys. Happy to be here.
We appreciate it. So go ahead and tell us a little more about yourself, if you can. Emily's given a bit of a professional intro, but how does the world of food impact everything that you do in your life and work?
Sure. Well, just to take it back a few years, I'll talk about how I got into nutrition, because that was not my first career path. Like Emily said, I have a master's in neuroscience, and I was involved in a research lab at the University of Delaware for 7 years off and on. And I really enjoyed that line of work, and I enjoyed doing research, but at some point I realized that that wasn't what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And then I started to, you know, look around at my life and what I was really passionate about and enjoying. And I had developed a love for baking and then cooking over time during college and then during my initial graduate degree. And because of that, I was thinking about, well, maybe I should do something that's more related to food. So I was poking around the internet, found out about the career of dietetics, and decided that that's what I wanted to do. So that's how I ended up at the Friedman School, and that's where I met Emily. And I did that. And then when I was getting my degree at Tufts, I was also getting a degree at Simmons to be able to do all the coursework necessary to become a dietitian. And then moved out to Ohio, did my internship, which is a required part of the registered dietitian credential. And then I finished that up and became credentialed in August. So in terms of how food affects my life and career, obviously it's something that was so important to me that it caused me to shift careers.
Sure.
But my interest in food and nutrition actually even goes back in time to before I was in college. I was a figure skater, and so nutrition was super important to what I was doing, even though I didn't really know it or think about it. I never saw a dietitian when I was training. It was just sort of, you know, something that my mom was taking care of in the background, making sure that both my sister and I were getting everything we needed and eating well to fuel our training. On the flip side of that, I also saw people that were struggling with food and nutrition. Saw people who were dealing with disordered eating or outright eating disorders. So that kind of influenced me as well. And I carried that through with me when I started my career in dietetics. So, and then now, you know, I love food. I love cooking all the time. My fiance and I love eating and cooking and baking and just everything food. I love talking about food all the time. So,
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Can you tell me a little more about your current job? You just got a new job, right, as a clinical dietitian?
Yes, so I just started a job with a hospital network in the Cincinnati area, and they have several facilities and hospitals all around the greater Cincinnati area. So I'm actually starting out in an optional position, which is PRN or as needed, but I'm basically going around and floating between the hospitals and then between the different units in the hospitals and covering whatever is needed. In terms of what an inpatient clinical dietitian does, the day-to-day is, you know, you're part of the interdisciplinary team. You're talking to the doctors, other therapies, and you're, you know, assessing patients' needs and making sure that while they're in the hospital, you're meeting their needs as best they can. So maybe that's making sure that if they're managing diabetes, they're getting a diabetic diet while they're in the hospital. Or maybe before they came into the hospital, they were having issues with appetite. So you're offering them something while they're in the hospital to either boost their appetite or to make sure they're getting appropriate calories and protein. Or if they're, you know, not able to eat or they need some sort of nutrition support, the dietitians are the ones that are responsible for doing the calculations and determining what's the best formula and method for, you know, providing somebody nutrition if they can't eat orally.
Oh, it sounds like we can go in a bunch of crazy directions here. It almost sounds like a comedy routine to ask, but I mean, this is like a sort of on road to talking about hospital food. So how are our people in a clinical setting like this able to get good quality food? What are they actually eating? Are they eating the food from a hospital cafeteria, or is something special being prepared for them?
No. So, and this can vary from hospital to hospital, especially there can be big differences from, you know, like local community hospitals where they don't have a large food service operation, mm-hmm. to the bigger hospitals, you know, where they have like 500-600 beds. So I'll talk about the hospital that I know the best since I just started this current job. The hospital where I did my internship was a large level one trauma center in Dayton, and they had their own food service operation where it was aimed at patient food service. So there were different diets that were tailored to different patient needs. So for example, that diabetic diet that I referenced, it's carbohydrate controlled. So they made sure that people were ordering a certain amount of carbohydrates, no more, no less, mm-hmm. so that they could be getting the same amount at breakfast, lunch, and dinner in the perfect world.
Sure.
Whether they were eating all those carbs it's an interesting story with respect to food waste. But anyway, so there were diets aimed at different patient populations, diabetic diet, renal diet, cardiac diet, you know, which is lower in salt and saturated fat. So, and in the big hospital that I'm working at here, they're doing the operation in kind of a similar fashion where there's different diets that are tailored to different people's needs, but it's their own food service operation, but there are, and I'm not an expert on this really, but there are like larger groups that have food service operations in many hospitals, and then it's more centrally controlled. And yeah, I'm not totally sure how that works. I actually only was exposed to that because the facility that I'm at now recently transitioned from doing that to being their own food service entity. Mm-hmm. But no, it doesn't come from like the same cafeteria where visitors would eat. It's the same kitchen, or maybe it's not the same kitchen, but it's different food items. But in a smaller facility, it could be all the same. Or sometimes I've heard of cases where sometimes they'll just go out to restaurants and pick up food for people and then bring it back.
Wow.
I don't know how often that really happens nowadays, but I'm sure that did happen at some point.
Wow. I mean, so what strikes me there is just that, in a sense, you are an expert in this, and the fact that that process of how the food is acquired for these people still sort of not being fully transparent to you is already quite interesting, because it means that all that sort of they're thinking about is the ends justifying the means, is being able to provide nutritional capacity for people, but then not really focusing too much on where the food comes from, as long as the food is there. So it strikes me that there's some sort of sorcerer here, a person who is focused on acquiring this food, whose job is secretly very important, but may not realize it.
Right. So there, I mean, again, to go back to the hospital where I did my training at, there was somebody who was a purchaser, and she was responsible for, you know, getting the food from different sources. And some of them were bigger companies like Gordon Food Service. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes it was a little bit more local, like they got bread from a local shop.
Great.
Actually.
Great.
In terms of thinking about whether things are, you know, organic or, you know, largely they're not going to be buying local products.
Right.
You know, you're buying in large volumes. But yeah, there is typically somebody who's focused on purchasing, and I think it depends on who that person is from hospital to hospital. At where I did my training, it happened to be a registered dietitian, but I don't think that's always the case.
Certainly. And that strikes me as an area of potential weakness in a treatment program, even when everyone in a position like yours is doing exactly what they should be doing. I think the part that most people know from just typical interactions with hospitals, and I think what they're seeing in media, is they do see this idea of the hospital cafeteria, and they think, wow, maybe this is not the best way to be feeding people. They don't realize there are other programs. They don't realize how it all comes together. So at least in the public perception, this is really not being observed very, very closely, which is interesting because people have to go to hospitals sometimes, and what you put in your body is almost as important as what's being done to it in a hospital.
Sure.
So that's a key part of treatment, I think.
Yeah, that's...
And there is... Yes, go ahead.
No, I just... This is really... I've never really even thought about this very much, so this is really interesting.
Yeah, and there's usually some sort of dietitian oversight. So whether the food service director or the department director is a dietitian, or maybe the patient food service manager, could be a dietitian. So there's usually some sort of dietitian oversight, not always, but that's just something that, you know, during our internship program, we get exposed to all that, but I wouldn't say that I know all of the ins and outs. It's just we kind of learn what's typical for the hospital that we were at. And again, it varies so much from hospital to hospital, and there's different yeah. methods and kind of different mindsets. And I will say in some places, food may have like a little bit more of a role, and they may have more of a focus on source and things like that. Mm-hmm, there's mm-hmm. another major hospital network up in the area where I did my internship that is Seventh-day Adventist. So the Seventh-day Adventists are typically vegetarians. So their food service operation would have been very different from ours, but you know, we never got to get any exposure to that. But that is something that it's not uncommon around the country, I would imagine.
It's really interesting. I wanted to go back a little bit to what you said about food waste, because we mm-hmm. are really interested in that topic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think did you volunteer at the Preventative Food Pantry in Boston Medical Center at mm-hmm. some point?
Yes, I did.
So I also was there for a while, and I was just thinking about that is also sort of the idea there is tailoring the diets
right.
to individual nutrition needs.
Right.
But it's really a focus, and it's really a focus on healthy food mm-hmm. access for lower income patients. And I think it's a really great idea. But then it's like, are they actually eating that food, you know, and how much is going to waste? And when right. you were talking about specifically at the hospital you were working at before, how these specifically tailored diets for diabetics, like you were kind of alluding to the fact that you don't think that they yes. were eating them all. Right.
Well, and that happens a lot. So again, the particular way at my old hospital where they did the diabetic diet was interesting because it follows the method of carbohydrate counting, which is pretty common, especially for people who are using insulin. It's kind of an easy method to figure out how many carbs you're getting. And again, it's important if you're getting insulin because you need to know how much insulin to give yourself at mealtime.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, so the way they did it at that particular hospital was they required you to order a certain number. But I mean, obviously, they're not going to make you eat everything you order. So, you know, if people really didn't want to meet their 60 grams of carbs, but they were being forced to order it, obviously stuff's going to get thrown away.
Wow.
And at that particular hospital, they actually composted, which was interesting.
Yeah.
I would imagine that the patient food service waste would go into that. I don't know how common that practice is, but I mean, yeah. there's a lot of cases in the hospital where people will have food order for them, and for one reason or another, like they went to a test or they had a procedure and they were tired, they missed the meal. You know, I think there's probably a lot of food waste generated in the hospital. So I would hope more places would incorporate that practice of composting to kind of help with that aspect, but I don't know how common it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, from our basic knowledge, I don't think it's all that common.
You can generally assume that a large facility like that isn't going to even consider the economic impact or the end value chain impact of food like that being thrown away. And so it's almost an afterthought. And I think outside right. the Northeast and California and maybe, you know, Oregon and Washington, you're not going to see a lot of large facilities even focusing on composting, although it's right. certainly very easy for them to do because they have the volume, they have the daily utility services that would make that relatively simple. Some municipalities right. may not even have programs that support that for large businesses or certain areas. So it could certainly be an area of immense food waste because there are so many people that are in facilities like hospitals. You have hundreds or thousands of patients at a certain time. So this is actually quite related, but I wanted to ask, you're helping in this context as a clinical or hospital-mediated dietitian. You're helping certain people, but that's only a small percentage of people at that facility, correct?
That's true. I would say through the screening processes that we do, you capture a lot of people through those processes, and you don't need to necessarily see everyone, and also kind of what takes precedence in the hospital setting is different than what's important in the outpatient setting. So sure. somebody might benefit from education on what a heart healthy diet is, but that may not be appropriate when they're in the hospital, or that may not be their focus because for the last month they've been dealing with nausea and vomiting and they just haven't been able to eat well and they've lost a ton of weight
mm-hmm.
and they might meet criteria for malnutrition. So in that moment, maybe that's the focus. But outpatient, before they were going through that, maybe they were overweight, you know, dealing with like hyperlipidemia and hypertension. So the focus in the hospital, I would say, is a little bit different. You're looking for people who are at nutrition risk. And sometimes that does just come down to, you know, maybe they don't have the proper education on how to follow a healthy diet if they're managing diabetes, and maybe they've come into the hospital because they're in DKA or diabetic ketoacidosis. So they, you know, weren't managing their diabetes and they got really acutely ill because of it. So in that moment, maybe that is the problem that you're addressing, and you might be helping to educate them on how to follow an appropriate diet outside the hospital and what to do. But sometimes it's something else. So we go through and, we don't see every patient who comes in. We can't possibly.
Of course.
But at the hospitals that I've been at, it's usually a dietitian that covers 2 to 3 floors. And then you're looking for certain kind of red flags. Like, is somebody really low weight or underweight? Have they had any sort of weight change? Are they reporting to nursing that they weren't eating well? Mm-hmm. Certain diagnoses, like people that have cancer, might be going through chemo, they have higher needs. Anybody who has wounds, they might have increased nutrient needs for wound healing. So you're looking for certain things to kind of catch the people that are at the highest risk. But it is true that sometimes we might end up seeing people that we don't really need to see or that may not be that high risk, and then we end up missing people who are at, unfortunately, high risk.
No, that makes perfect sense. And I think one of the things that strikes us about hospitals and anyone who has sort of any experience with the medical community at large is realizing that in the United States, at least, we unfortunately practice a lot of just approach-based and reactive medicine, unfortunately. It's not preventative. Mm-hmm. We're seeing people at their worst because something bad has happened and they require acute treatment. So it's very possible that a large percentage of people entering a facility could need help in this and other regards. And I think you could certainly spot the need for a dietitian in perhaps at least a third of Americans at this point due to what we see just happening in the American diet. So, but that wouldn't certainly be necessarily immediately life-threatening. I think it certainly affects the lives of a lot of people these days. Can you give our listeners a sense of how many people would be in a hospital setting like this? I know you said one dietitian per 2 to 3 floors. Is that 100 people, 1,000 people? What's the scale here?
I think it depends on the floor. I'm trying to think. Again, I'm floating around and I'm getting oriented to this new hospital setting.
Sure.
But let's see.
Just roughly.
For example, what's today, Sunday? Just Friday, I was only covering one medical surgical floor in one of the kind of a medium-sized hospital. I don't know what their number of beds is, but it's not the biggest hospital that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, there were 34 patients. Mm-hmm. So typically somebody would be having a higher load than that. And it doesn't mean you see 34 patients. You know, you go through and you screen people based on how long they've been there. And again, did they report certain things to nursing that would be a red flag? But it could be, I mean, you could be covering up to 60 patient beds on a given day. Again, with these two hospitals that I've been at, or two hospital systems, I should say, you could be covering up to 60 beds on a given day. And then maybe, if you're lucky, my old hospital, we were able to see 15 to 20 people in a day.
Mm-hmm.
At the current hospital network I'm at, our goal is kind of 10 to 15, I would say.
Sure. Yeah, that already sounds like a lot of people. And it sounds like each individual human perhaps has different needs. And already that's a lot of work. And I'm guessing the hospital doesn't want to hire 2 to 3 more of you for that kind of patient load.
No. And it's kind of interesting. At the hospital where I did my internship training, they had a lot of full-time dietitians. And then at this hospital network, they have more people that are, they're not full-time, but they're close.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not exactly part-time. Like, I think a lot of them are maybe 32 hours a week, and a lot of them go different places, which I think is an interesting strategy. But, and then me and another girl are filling in the gaps.
So in your current position right now, you're doing lots of, it's all inpatient, but like lots of different kinds of cases, like diabetes, pregnancy, and everything.
Everything. We cover basically any unit in the hospital. If one of the dietitians is out, we'll sub in for them. And then we might be at, there's like three or four hospitals that we would rotate through. And then usually there's dietitian coverage on the weekends, maybe one to two people per facility, depending on how big the facility is. So you take consults typically on the weekends.
I'd love for you to chat a little bit about the sorts of dietary differences and suggested differences in food intake between different sorts of patients. Like Emily was just saying, you're seeing a lot of different types of people. How does what you're looking at giving to a malnourished person vary from what's going to a pregnant mother or someone who's just had heart surgery? What are the kind of actual dietary differences there?
Sure. So again, I kind of went into the example of like the what a cardiac diet is in our hospital, limiting saturated fat,
sure.
Definitely limiting salt, obviously encouraging fruits and vegetables, whole grains for sources of fiber. And I talked a little bit about the diabetic diet. And I mean, most of the hospital foods are relatively healthy and made with not a lot of salt, not like typical restaurant food, just
sure.
because you want to minimize how many different kinds of ways you're preparing things for different people's needs. So I would say, and I would make the assumption that in the hospital setting, most foods are fairly low sodium, which is good for almost everybody. So then for the diabetic diet, you're just trying to encourage people to order a similar quantity of carbohydrates at each meal. And then it's relatively calorie controlled.
Mm-hmm.
There's a renal diet where you're focusing on intake of certain nutrients. Certain nutrients are limited, I should say, because when your kidneys aren't working as well, you're not able to excrete certain things and things get out of balance. So that's probably the most restrictive diet. And we try to get people off the renal diet as much as we can because
sure.
it's just so limiting for people.
Sure.
And it's not always necessary, especially in the inpatient setting, but especially long term, it may not be necessary depending on what their needs are. But a lot of populations, well, you mentioned cardiac surgery patients, somebody's having open heart surgery, obviously you want them to be following a heart healthy diet outpatient, but also making sure they get enough protein, because after you have some sort of major surgical procedure like open heart surgery, it's really important for healing both internally and, you know, the scars that they typically have.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who has wounds could benefit from having more protein in their diet. And in the hospital setting, a convenient way to give people more protein is to offer some sort of a nutritional supplement. So something like Ensure Boost, those, you know, shakes you see at the store and advertised on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll offer those to people who they may be having increased needs because they had a procedure or wounds or something like that. Or maybe they're having early satiety when they're eating, so they're not feeling very hungry, they're not eating well, so
sure.
the liquid calories can be a good way to boost somebody's intake and make sure they're getting enough calories and protein for whatever they've got going on.
Sure.
And really anybody, most people who come into the hospital has some sort of a higher nutrient need because they're sick, like something bad is happening,
mm-hmm.
they have an infection,
right,
something's going on, so they just need more. So that's what I was kind of talking about before, where I feel like those issues sort of take precedence over the maybe some of the outpatient issues, like maybe this person isn't really following the healthiest diet at home and maybe this isn't the time and place to address that, or maybe it is. It really depends on the patient.
I was just about to actually ask that, in the sense of, in what capacity do you provide advice that goes into a patient's life after they leave the hospital? Or is it really you're providing an acute treatment and then hope for the best after they leave?
It depends on the patient. I think every once in a while, in my limited experience, again, I'm a new dietitian, you know, you encounter somebody who's really, you know, not, first of all, not very sick. So they're not dealing with something that would prevent them from listening to some sort of dietary advice. And also they're ready to make some sort of a change in their diet. So, you know, maybe somebody who came in cardiac arrest and they're like, wow, I really want to make some lifestyle changes to prevent this from happening again.
Yeah.
But I feel like the people that are, you know, in that headspace to make some sort of a change that they would need to follow at home, it's kind of few and far between, I would say. And
wow.
For most people, it's not really inappropriate, I wouldn't think, because, again, the focus is typically different in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, if you have somebody who's coming in, like somebody who's an oncology patient and they're going through chemo and they just can't keep anything down, nothing tastes good. they're going to be obviously receptive to doing something to improve their nutrition status, but that's not going to be necessarily like eating more fruits and vegetables. It's going to be like, you need to drink a milkshake or whatever you can keep down because you just need to get enough calories and protein to get yourself through treatment and then focus on following a quote unquote healthy diet down the line.
I took a class at Friedman, and there was a dietitian who worked with burn patients. I just think you mentioned a lot of things, and I don't think you mentioned that, so I don't really know that much about that, but I just found that really interesting because I had never even thought about like that burn patients have a lot of particular nutritional needs.
Higher fluid needs, protein needs, particular micronutrients can be helpful for healing. Burns are really,
I mean,
really interesting.
I guess it makes sense because, you know, if you burn an entire part of your skin, you know, you're losing a lot of nutrients. So that was just a comment. And then I know are you hoping to go into a particular field in the future? I know you're interested in like pregnancy. Is that true?
Yeah. I think, you know, this position that I took it mainly because it's really good experience. Obviously I'm getting exposed to a lot of things.
For sure, you know,
in your internship, in the dietetic internship, I went through what, like 17 weeks and was exposed to all these things, but now it's reinforcement. I'm kind of building my own clinical judgment. So this kind of a job right out of the gate of the internship is really amazing for
me. Oh yeah, for sure.
I think no matter what I want to do, I could see myself doing something inpatient. As far as inpatient goes, I really like critical care. So that's a lot of nutrition support. So doing enteral or tube feeding recommendations, doing parenteral nutrition, which is the nutrition that they deliver through the bloodstream, so it bypasses the GI tract. But on the flip side, I would really like to do outpatient too, but I think I would like to get a little bit more comfortable with counseling first before I jump into that. But if I did do outpatient, I would love to work with pregnant women. I would love to get into the fertility sphere. I think it's really interesting, and it fits into my background with what I was doing in neuroscience before I switched to nutrition.
So tell us, I know you just co-authored a book that sort of focuses on nutritious mocktails for pregnant women. So that kind of fits in here. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So my good friend, Diana Licalzi, I met her at Tufts as well, but she and I wrote this book, Drinking for Two, Nutritious Mocktails for the Mom-to-Be. It was actually, the idea came from her cousin and his wife, and they work at a small publishing company called Blue Star Press, and they approached Diana with this idea for doing a mocktail book for pregnant women. They were like, well, who do you think should write this? Should an OB-GYN write it? Should a dietitian write it? And Diana was like, well, obviously this is something a dietitian should do, and I want to do it. So
being a dietitian herself.
Yeah.
Just go ahead.
No, just being a dietitian herself.
Right. So she came to me. When I was in neuroscience, I worked in a lab that studied the effects of alcohol exposure on the developing brain during pregnancy. So I had that background and that interest in nutrition and pregnancy. So she came to me, asked me to come on board with her. And after a year of, you know, doing research that went into the book and doing all of the R&D for all of our mocktail recipes, now we have this amazing book. So
awesome. Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you. It was really fun.
It's exciting.
And we'll certainly put links to that in the podcast description and in the media that we produce with this. It's great to have more resources available to people. I think what strikes me as interesting about this is we're getting into the idea of what pregnant women should be eating and drinking. And with a guide like this, you are making a declarative statement that it's perhaps not alcohol. So talk? I mean, this sounds like, to a bunch of people who are versed in this, this sounds like a real no-brainer. But I think to the average person, the jury is not out, even though perhaps it should be out on the effects of alcohol while pregnant.
Right. Well, and we were talking a little bit earlier about taking risks. And for me personally, I don't know why when so many, it's such a vulnerable time, pregnancy. And there's so many things that are out of your control that can go wrong. When you can do something to control the risk of something happening, like eliminating alcohol, why wouldn't you do it?
Yeah.
And some people would argue that And even I've even heard doctors make this statement to people that, you know, well, a sip here and there won't kill you, or, you know, like, if you're feeling stressed, like, a glass of wine's not gonna do any harm. And especially with respect to stress, I think that's such a terrible recommendation, because that's alcohol is not the way you should be dealing with stress anyway.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, that's not really appropriate. But I mean, there's so many arguments against not drinking alcohol during pregnancy. You know, people used to do it back in the day, and their kids turned out fine. I know my friend drank while she, I'm not speaking as me, I'm speaking as somebody else, but like, oh, I know my friend drank while she was pregnant and her kid turned out fine. And in other countries, it's a little bit more acceptable to drink while you're pregnant. But, you know, we've actually, it's very hard to study how many people may be affected by alcohol exposure during pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And there has been new research that have shown that as many as 1 to 5% of kids in 4 different communities that they actually looked at in the study may be affected by FASD or fetal alcohol spectrum disorder.
Wow.
So, I mean, I don't think people realize that it can be as common as it is.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's just so easy to avoid it. It's 100% preventable.
Precisely. I think with a culture like America's, with a culture like what you see in the majority of the world, I would wager, drinking is a daily part of life for so many adults. I mean, we're talking about seeing recent studies that show people are drinking more than 6 drinks per day, male and female, every day in some countries. In some modern developed countries with modern developed senses of nutrition and diet and environment. So it's really going to crop up in those locales, and it's going to become an issue if it hasn't already been an issue for children.
Yeah.
Or we'll at least be able to see the sorts of effects that we once thought were mysterious ailments being attributable to drinking while pregnant. And we agree with you completely. I think when you can mitigate risk like that for a period of months, it's so simple, and control the outcome of an entire new human being, we think that's critical. We spend a lot of time here talking about how people can change their own diets to make their own human existence a little bit better and more sustainable, and increase their brain and body health just by changing what they eat. It is completely possible to change the health of the other human you are eating for while pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, and it's definitely not doing anybody any favors. I mean, alcohol doesn't have any positive effects on, you know, maybe resveratrol, but it's not going to help your baby in any way.
Which can be taken as a supplement without the alcohol. So
yeah,
if someone really wanted that.
Or you know, eat fruits. get it from those food sources.
Exactly.
That's fine too.
Exactly.
I have a question, since we're really interested in like sustainable eating and sustainable diets. I noticed the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, which is the registering agency for registered dietitians, they have come out with more articles recently. There's specifically one here called Sustainable Eating. And I think it's becoming more potentially of a trend and more popular for dietitians to think about recommending how people can eat more sustainably. And I don't necessarily think, I mean, I don't, in an inpatient setting, it might not be appropriate. I'm not really, maybe more of in an outpatient setting,
mm-hmm.
but
yeah.
I guess just what are your thoughts on sustainable eating in general and the role that maybe dietitians can play?
Sure. Well, and we were talking a little bit about this before we came on, at, you know, I won't claim to be an expert, but you know, I did read the Eat Lancet study that many people are aware of that, you know, kind of showed that plant-based eating is more sustainable than, you know, eating a more meat-centered diet. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of good evidence that is along those lines, and I tend to believe that. But there is something to say, like, you know, a plant-based diet, you know, you also need to define what a plant-based diet is. You know,
oh,
does that mean you're eating vegan? Does that mean you're incorporating any sort of dairy or egg products? And I think for some populations, they really need to have animal products in their diet to be healthy, including women who are pregnant. It becomes very difficult when you're trying to build another human and there's certain nutrients that you need. You can't always get them from plant-based sources. So maybe that's not the best time to follow a 100% vegan diet. Or maybe it is for you. I think it really depends on the person and what they're doing. But and I think you can support good practices when you're buying foods. Like if you're able to financially, looking for things that are local, looking for, you know, even meat that's local or dairy that's local, eggs that are local and that are, you know, well sourced. I wish there was a little bit more direction on how to do that with labeling. And because I know eggs, for example, they have so many labels and they all, like, none of them are really regulated labels. Some of them are, some of them aren't. But I wish there was like an easy way to find sustainable animal products or things that are a little bit more sustainable.
Yeah.
And then even beyond like what you're choosing for foods, just having good food practices, like trying to minimize food waste, cooking at home more, I think you can be more sustainable because, you know, if you're packing up your lunch like I do almost every day and bringing it to work versus having something that comes in a plastic container at work and, you know, they're just, I don't know, in a food service operation, it's a little bit harder to be conscientious about sustainability. I think more people are trying to go in that direction. But if you're doing stuff at home, I think you can be in control, try to limit food waste, use sustainable packaging, like I was saying, and limit plastics and things like that. So I think that's one thing that's not only beneficial to health if you're making your own meals, but also good for the environment too.
There's a lot you touched on there. Yeah, we've talked. No, that's great. We talked about, I mean, labeling. There's a lot of issues in labeling and transparency that we're really interested in exploring. Yeah, I don't have a lot on that, right? Do you have more thoughts on that?
Yeah, so what's interesting is that Emily and I dug into labeling a couple of days ago, actually.
Oh, yeah.
And discovered that to apply the non-GMO label to foods in at least this country, it's required that you go through an agency that can supply this designation for you by doing a certain amount of testing and oversight to your product or products. And what we realized was almost every single one of these agencies was actually either run or directly controlled by a person or small group of people with a food industry tie who stood to profit from marking their own products as more sustainable or in some commercially related way could potentially benefit from their own company's labeling activities.
In that particular example.
And there's nothing wrong with that designation, but it points to the fact that what we're looking at is a situation where it's very challenging to establish a chain of command, to establish ethical controls here, and it's challenging to get people with the most knowledge to actually be the ones that write these sorts of standards that we have to follow. And so it's almost challenging for us to provide, and I'm sure for you as well, to provide recommendations about these sorts of things, because even acquiring the information is fraught with pitfalls and challenges. So it's something we encounter all the time, and I can only imagine a non-professional's difficulty in attempting to figure out these situations, to figure out what they should and should not be eating. I mean, even with professional advice, you could be told, eat a certain food, and then not knowing all the issues with that particular food, go in and actually be making a really poor decision based on how that food was sourced or some sort of additive or preservative or dye that was included in the packaging of that particular item. So you can really run into a huge problem if someone says you just need to increase your protein and their response to that is to go and eat more hamburgers at a fast food restaurant. That's not going to do them any favors, certainly.
Yeah.
Even if it follows a macronutrient guideline. So we really run into this quite often in our world, and I'm sure you do as well.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if in an outpatient setting, as I was kind of saying, there might be more room for dietitians to give advice on this kind of thing.
I think so. I mean, I don't know how many people are doing it now. I don't know how much. I think probably consumer interest is on the rise, which will then feed into dietitians getting more questions about it and getting more interested in about it. I don't know. I think we're kind of at the beginning.
Yeah.
So I've never had anybody ask me about how to follow a more sustainable diet. But again, on the inpatient side, I wouldn't really expect that.
Yeah. Right.
I don't think that's really on people's radars right now. And that could also be my location. You know, maybe if I was on the East Coast, you know, if I had done my training in Boston, or if I was living in California, things would be a little bit different.
Right.
there's, you know, it's very important.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But again, I think, you know, there's recommendations that could be given on what foods should be eaten or should be avoided or, you know, limited, or how you can make a better choice with a given type of food, sort of things to look for in general. But yeah, just in general, all those food practices that I was talking about, like, you know, cooking at home, buying stuff at the grocery store,
for sure,
finding ways to like upcycle ingredients and minimize food waste. Those are all things that, you know, the average person can do, and it's good for health and for the environment.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Those are really great just overall recommendations for that most people, like the average person, can follow. Because I think, yeah, I mean, I have a little bit of a problem like telling people to, you know, who are already worried about, you know, their financial situation or their nutrition to, you know, go out and, you know, buy like organic, non-GMO everything, because right. of the potential financial barrier there. So yeah, I think recommendations like that I'm really in support of, where you can try to eat a little bit more sustainably just by like cooking at home or reducing waste, stuff like that.
Yeah, it's all about meeting people where they're at when you're giving any sort of a recommendation. But just because you brought up the organic issue, and that's a monster issue that, again, I'm not an expert on, but we did include a little section on it in the back of our book. It's one of our appendices.
Oh, okay.
I thought it was really important to talk about the research on organic food and health, and how there really isn't a lot of research on organic food and health.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's research that suggests that exposure to pesticides used in food production can have negative outcomes, you know, cancer. There's the study that was done in children in California that was looking at exposure that women had during pregnancy, and whether I have that here too. It's a crazy acronym, but we can put that in the link. But yeah, so those, obviously from that perspective, purchasing organic foods is better on the whole. And there could maybe be some risk of being exposed to pesticides through food, but research hasn't really demonstrated that yet. I think it's demonstrated that the pesticides you do get that through food. But then also, you know, there are organic pesticides, so either way, you might be exposed to something. But anyway, so the conclusion of what I was saying in this short appendix that I wrote, that was just kind of the biggest point that I wanted to get across, is that, you know, if buying organic products is a barrier to you getting a healthy diet, then that should not be your concern. You know, eating fruits and vegetables is documented to be good for you, whereas choosing organic versus non-organic, it might be better for people to eat organic, but that's just not attainable for most people. So really, until, you know, all that changes and things become more readily available and not as expensive, which who knows when that will be, really just eating well and not thinking about that stuff is the most important.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that's like supported by dietitians. I've seen a lot of other dietitians say, don't get hung up on that.
That's a great point. And surprisingly, we do support that.
Well, not surprisingly for me, I tell you that all the time. I think I do have a master's in nutrition. I'm not a dietitian, but to me, it's very clear from the evidence that the benefits you would get from eating non-organic produce in terms of your health outweigh the potential risks of some pesticides.
Exactly. And just going back to the overall plant-based diet, the point is that is always going to be better for one's health, and we understand that. I think one of the core tenets of the GMO debate is people ignoring the fact that we're talking about large-scale environmental and systemic problems. So washing a field in pesticides may not actually poison a single person who eats the produce from that field, but it may destroy the livelihoods and the water, food, and air system for everyone around that particular farm for generations to come. And those people very much matter.
Yeah. Right. So we will definitely talk more about the GMO organic thing, because we both have strong opinions on this. But what Noah has gotten me to see is that I think the environmental impacts of at least the way GMOs are being used now in this country are really really what I see as the main issue with GMOs. Oh, for sure. You know, like the health effects, I think, are basically negligible. Really, it's about the environmental impacts.
Sure. Well, and the interesting thing about GMOs is there's, what, only 10 GMO products that are approved in the U.S. or something like that currently? It's a very
low number. Sounds right.
And where do most of those GMO products go? Into the fast food and processed food industry, like corn, soy. They're used regularly in the fast food industry. So, like, if you really care about GMOs, you know, maybe cut back on McDonald's, but you know, you're not going to find it in your, I don't know, your spinach or something, to my knowledge.
Exactly. And the health effects of McDonald's food is nothing to do with it being GMO, or might have something to do, but is chiefly related to it being produced with an incredibly high amount of fat and sugar and salt and just the worst kinds of things you want to put in your body, which I think is a surprising point for most people. They're still consuming fast food at a shocking rate, even with all this new information that we have about how it is quite bad for people and for the environment.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to sort of make the connection here that Eat Lancet report, you know, the idea of sustainable eating is good for both you and the planet, like a plant-based diet. In so many cases, like, I do think that's a general, it's a good, like, general public health recommendation, because I think by focusing on a plant-based diet, you eliminate, you know, you reduce your consumption of fast food just by nature, and then you just naturally are going to reduce the amount of negative things you're going to be putting in your mouth.
On the flip side, you're eating more healthy things like fruits and vegetables and whole grains and legumes and things like that. So it's just, it's kind of like about, for me, a plant-based diet is more like plant-centered. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the focus is on eating a lot of plant foods.
Right.
But, you know, I'm not a vegan. Mm-hmm. I definitely eat animal products, and I have tried vegan diets in the past, and I think I do better when I do incorporate some meat, some dairy, definitely eggs in my diet. But, you know, definitely, like, the focus of my plates and at every meal, I'm eating fruits and vegetables, whole grains, legumes, and, you know, eating foods that are in kind of their true form versus foods that are packaged to the greatest extent possible. You know, I don't always boil my own beans. I usually get them in a can.
Sure.
But I mean, beyond that, like, we really limit our intake of processed foods and eat quote unquote real foods as much as possible. And I think that's another way to be more sustainable, because then if you're buying things in their true form, you're not getting all that packaging and any sort of waste that's generated in the process of making food, things like that. And obviously they're the most nutritious because it's the source of the food.
Precisely. That's actually a great segue.
That's a great point. Yeah.
A great segue in my mind to chatting a little bit about your professional opinion on some diets that are out there, because just talking about lack of packaging and things that are close to the earth reminds me, of course, of the paleo diet. But from what we've seen, a lot of diets are, they can certainly be a distraction from talking about sustainability, but are also not necessarily always rooted in strong nutritional fundamentals. So the main problem with that could be people's discipline and likelihood of actually following a good diet or following a good lifestyle. But I'd love for you to chat a little about on what it looks like to actually maybe use some of those diets and incorporate them, or not to. Do you think those are fads that should die and go away, or is there something one can gather from them?
I mean, there's a lot of different diets. Like, which ones are you thinking about in particular?
I think a lot of dietitians these days would agree. I don't love the term diet. It implies it's something that's short term and kind of maybe not a quick fix, but it's usually some sort of a quick fix. And you know, the goal is to lose weight, and then you're following it to the T, or maybe you're not following it to the T, and then, you know, you fall off the bandwagon, or you end the diet and you don't change any of your habits for the long term, and then you end up back to square one. So, I mean, there's not a lot of diets that I would be supportive of. I mean, don't even get me started, or really, again, any dietitian started on the keto diet.
Right.
We won't. You know, first of all, what are people even calling a keto diet? Like, a true ketogenic diet is not something that is pleasant to follow, and most people don't feel good being on it.
Right.
And it's really lacking in fiber and a lot of essential nutrients, and it was a medical diet that was developed for people who have epilepsy. So it's not something that was designed to be followed for the long term for most people.
I almost feel like I have to bring these things up, because in the podcast world, every single day, people mm-hmm. with very, very, very sizable followings, we're talking about tens of millions of listeners around the world, are actively promoting diets like this to mm-hmm. their many millions of followers. And they're interviewing dietitians who are coming on and likewise helping them promote these diets to their followers. Now, it also stands to make them heaps of money in certain situations, selling supplements or certain foods to them. But it's really, certainly in podcast land, become something very, very popular to talk about. And forgive me for, in a way, prodding you to say it's a bad idea, because we agree. And that's what the actual professional opinion seems to be, looking at people who don't have a vested interest in selling you something. It is that
right.
These diets are short-term. They are focused on very specific needs that may not be the average person's needs, and they're not indicative of overall healthy behavior. They're
right.
They're too hyper-specialized in many cases.
Right.
So it's
I think most,
good to hear that.
You know, a lot of dietitians and other professionals would prefer the term, you know, lifestyle.
Right.
Yeah. That's why I even try to... I mean, I guess I say plant-based diet, but I try to stay away a word. Oh, sorry, I try to avoid that word as much as possible.
Sure.
Because I really don't like it, and it's just, you know, the way it's become used in our food mm-hmm. culture is just ridiculous. And there's just so many diets out there, and you know, I think there's some research that shows, you know, weight fluctuation and following diets and going on and off diets actually has negative outcomes with respect to long-term weight. I don't have any statistics
yeah.
or studies off the top of my head, but I mean, I've heard that before, you know, yo-yo dieting
mm-hmm.
And how that can negatively affect people's weight in the long term.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I don't know. I guess I see the negative implications with the word diet, but you said you prefer lifestyle. I was going to ask you, before what you prefer, because like a plant-based diet or even like a whole food diet, right, you would probably support those type of things, but
right.
yeah, it's better yeah. to just, you think it's better to maybe not call it a diet.
Yeah, this is a semantics thing here. I can
yeah
we can disentangle that.
I get hung up on that, I guess, but.
Sure. No, but
yeah.
it's tough to call something the way someone eats and not talk about diet, just like we're
right.
changing
yeah.
the word
it's...
temperature and climate.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, it's not a huge deal. I just, you know, the word diet has just become kind of a cringy word.
Certainly.
To me.
That's
but it doesn't mean it can't be used well. It's just not being used well, I guess. I don't know. But like you said, it can refer to a lot of things. But also, like, all of these labels and terms, they're kind of restrictive. So even, like, mm-hmm. I don't know, plant-based is... And there's also, like, what do they mean? You know, like, you're following
yeah.
a keto diet. What does that mean exactly? You're following a plant-based diet. What does that mean exactly? You know, it's better to just, you know, say, like, I'm focusing on eating real foods versus processed foods. And mm-hmm. I try to get a lot of fruits and vegetables in every day, something like that, rather than putting like a label on it. But every, you know, we always want to put labels on things. That's just our nature.
Yeah. Me even more so.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think we just generally would support a healthy, sustainable lifestyle. I think that's what we're ultimately trying to promote here. Do you have any other thoughts? I think we're getting close to an hour. So.
Yeah, we've almost done a full hour of this. It's been really wonderful. But I think the core of this is basically what we're hearing is it's very possible to give good advice to people, but it's very hard to package that advice into a 90-second soundbite. And so often on the news and even in other podcasting environments, I think people are prone to try and reduce perhaps years of study or years of their own anecdotal research into something that sounds really good when it's in the title of an episode or when it's projected on a website somewhere. And eating well isn't that challenging, but it's not a 90-second soundbite. It's not an article headline. It's a series of activities, and it's a little bit of effort. And it's not exactly what might appear in the media in America and other places. It's a little bit more challenging than that, simply because we're surrounded by a lot of really bad food advice. That's producing
a lot
of things.
And it's so hard when, you know, you have nutrition, and everybody cares about nutrition and food. Everybody has an opinion, and it's very personal, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's influenced by, you know, cultures and environment right. and so many things. And, you know, when a new study comes out and it's got, you know, a different outcome than what was expected, it's like, well, then what do you believe? But, you know, what people don't understand is that it's not just one study. You have to look at the whole body of research, and you have to really look at how was the study done? Was it a good design? And, you know, is what they're saying in the media and is even what they're saying in the conclusions of the study really what the results are? You know, things that, like, you know, we learned in our epidemiology classes at Tufts, you know, that we're kind of trained to think about, but the average person doesn't necessarily know to think about it that critically.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just nutrition research is so hard.
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole other thing there about how, like, science communication, mm-hmm. and, which is an interesting topic, but maybe that's for another time. You know, how do we condense the information so that people are interested in it without leaving out important subtleties?
And speaking of the information, can either of you, just for the listener's sake, think of a good spot online people can go to find unbiased information? This is not a trick question, but I think it's a challenging thing for most people, and they're going to listen to this and they're going to think, okay, well, I've heard this call to action. What's the next step? Where do I actually get this good advice from?
That's a good question. Well, I mean, if you really wanted to be thorough, you would go and look at whatever journal articles are being published. So really going to the source, but that can be a lot of, you know, jargon that it's not, you know, used by the average person necessarily and could be really overwhelming. I mean, I get news briefs from the National Institute of Health. I think they have, you know, science news briefs that could be helpful and kind of, they talk about new studies in a way that I would hope was unbiased. So mm-hmm. I would say that's a pretty good source.
Great.
Even just in, you know, like the CDC, USDA, I would hope that any research that they're talking about is unbiased.
You'd be surprised, but in general, that is a true statement.
It's hard. No, I mean, yeah. I mean, what is unbiased? I mean, nothing's totally unbiased. Right. I was wondering, do you think the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics might be a good place? Or?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
That's what came to my mind, yeah. Mm-hmm. For nutrition specific. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's been about an hour. We really appreciate your time. Unless there's anything else you want to urgently discuss, I think we had a great conversation here.
We certainly did. And please tell folks where they can find you online and get you a book.
Sure. So I have a small but hopefully gaining steam Instagram account. And it's Healthy Cravings, but it's CRAYVINGS.
Mm-hmm. Cute. Yeah.
And I have a website that's kind of in the works, so we'll, you know, leave that for you to find through my Instagram.
Certainly.
And our book, Drinking for Two, again, I wrote with my co-author, Diana Lacauzzi, is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, Walmart, and anywhere books are sold.
Awesome, yeah.
Excellent.
I think it's great for, like, a baby shower.
Right, for sure.
Yeah. Amazing gift for a baby shower.
Or gender reveal party.
Gender reveal party. Oh, yeah, those are so gaining steam.
They certainly are.
Yep.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks, guys. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks again.